So there are, in the text before us, there are a number of parallels between this account and the account that we just studied when John sends his disciples to inquire of Jesus. So in both accounts, sinners are open to the message of Jesus. In Luke 7:29, we read, "When all the people and tax collectors heard this, they acknowledged God's justice, having been baptized with the baptism of John." And of course, in Luke 7:47-50, the woman who approaches Jesus is accepting. In both accounts, Pharisees are the antagonists. In Luke 7 and verse 30, the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected God's purpose for themselves, not having been baptized by John. And of course, we have some resistance from Simon in Luke 7, 40-47. In both accounts, Jesus teaches by means of a brief parable. In Luke 7:32, we see him using the parable of mourning and playing the flute, and then in the text before us, the parable of the debtors. And in both cases, the response of Jesus' counterpart, either John in the first case or Simon in the second case, is left unanswered. We're not sure how they respond to what they have heard. And so these parallels are going to help us, I think, sort through some of the major themes of this account. So think about those as we go through here. There are also very clearly strong ties back to Luke chapter 5 in verses 17-26, where Jesus heals the paralytic. In both cases, in Luke 5:21. And Luke 7:49, in both cases we have people questioning Jesus forgiving sins. And so, again, we want to keep these parallels in mind to see the themes that evolve through Luke's gospel and see these stories in their context. So let's pick up in Luke 7:36. I appreciate Matt reading that for us. Now, one of the Pharisees was requesting him to dine with him. And he entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. And there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. And when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster vial of perfume. And standing behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and kept wiping them with the hair of her head and kissing his feet and anointing them with perfume. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner." Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to say to you." And he said, "Say it, teacher." And we'll look at the parable in just a minute. And I want to look at sort of how this story unfolds here. First of all, we have the invitation, and he receives an invitation from a Pharisee. And the Pharisees really haven't gotten a great reputation in the Gospel of Luke up to this point. They have constantly been the antagonists of Jesus. So in Luke 5:21, the scribes and Pharisees began to reason, saying, "Who is this man who speaks blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but God alone?" And in Luke chapter 5 and verse 30, the Pharisees and scribes began grumbling at his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" In Luke chapter 5 and verse 33, they again question Jesus about not fasting. In Luke chapter 6 and verse 2, the Pharisees said, "Why do you do what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And in Luke chapter 6 and verse 7, they're watching him to see if he will heal on the Sabbath. And so over and over and over and over again, The Pharisees are combative with Jesus. Now, we don't want to be too quick to tar Simon with that same brush, although he does manifest some of the same attitudes initially. And so let's at least withhold judgment until we look at the text, but it is certainly fair to say that he is part of a group that has been highly antagonistic to Jesus. And so there are a couple of things that are of note about this initially. First of all, the idea that they're reclining at the table suggests that this is a more formal, more festive occasion. It's not just a casual sort of thing, but a much more formal dinner occasion. The other thing that's interesting is that up to this point in the gospel, Jesus has accepted invitations from both tax collectors and Pharisees. So back in Luke 5:29 and following, Levi invites Jesus into his home. And Jesus goes. And he sits down and he eats with the tax collectors and sinners. And now a Pharisee invites Jesus into his home, and he goes and he sits down and he eats with Simon. And in both cases, he acted redemptively toward these people. Our prejudices tend to run in one direction or another. Some people see someone who is religiously hypocritical, and I'm not having anything to do with that guy. Well, that was not Jesus' approach. Jesus' approach was, I'm going to act redemptively toward this man. Some people look at sinners and say, they're beyond help. I'm not having anything to do with them. That was not Jesus' approach. Jesus saw someone who was a tax collector, obviously a pariah in that society, and he said, well, I'm going to act redemptively to them. And so Jesus is rather indiscriminate in who he is trying to reach with the gospel. And I think there's a lesson in that. We need to be rather indiscriminate in who we try and reach with the gospel. We don't need to cherry pick. We don't need to go out looking for candidates. Someone, and this was somewhat cynical, granted, but someone said, there's some congregations where it looks like you have to be white, Republican, homeschool, and use essential oils to be a member. Now, you either think that's funny or you don't, but while somewhat cynical, not always altogether wrong. And that we don't need to be taking the gospel only to people like us, unless our view of people like us is that they're sinners like us. That needs to be the criteria. And that's Jesus' criteria. He'd go anywhere. Obviously, he came to earth, so the standards can't be too high. Jesus wanted both to be saved. So he goes in, he reclines at the table with Simon. And in these kinds of situations, not everybody could come up to the table, but people could come in as long as they stayed on the periphery. They could come in and they could witness these kinds of events. And a woman is introduced. And she is introduced based on what she has done. We are told in the text here in Luke chapter 7 that there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. And this is Luke speaking at this point. And she comes in and falls at Jesus' feet. So there are a couple of things that I think we need to note here First of all, we're all to some degree understood by what we've done, but there are kind of two sides to this tale. So there's a woman in the city who was a sinner. Okay, that's on the one hand. At some point, she had done something notorious. Okay, and I know she always gets painted as an immoral woman in a sort of sexual sense. We don't really know that. The text doesn't really tell us that. Some things have been interpreted that way, but they don't have to be interpreted that way. But she had done something notorious, whatever that was. But I want us to notice something else that she's done. Okay? She learned that he was reclining at the table. She brought an alabaster flask to anoint him. And she wet his feet with her tears. She wiped his feet with her hair. And she anointed his feet with the ointment. That's also what she's done. And so this woman comes in. And this is sort of an interesting reversal for Luke in one way. Because we don't know the woman's name, which is fascinating to me. Because usually in situations like this, that's reversed. So you think about the rich young ruler and Zacchaeus. Okay, the rich young ruler was wealthy and prominent probably in Jewish society, but we have no idea what his name is in Luke's gospel. He doesn't tell us. But he does tell us the name of that miserable little tax collector. And the same thing goes for the rich man and Lazarus. Certainly, people knew the rich man's name. People usually know rich man's names. What they usually don't know is they don't know the name of the beggar on the street corner. Their names are not so common, but that's you see, it's reversed in both cases. Here, we don't know the name of the woman. We know the name of Simon. And that's interesting to me. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that in just a minute. But I just want to note that because it's very unlike Luke to carry it out this way. If it was, you know, Sarah and the Pharisee or something. I don't know if her name's Sarah or not. But Sarah and the Pharisee, that would be more common for Luke to do something like that. But that's not what he does here. And I want to suggest a reason why here in just a minute. So she is weeping at Jesus' feet. And again, whatever, some people have interpreted some of this, some of these things in certain ways. But it had to create quite a scene. The tears, the weeping, the ointment, all of this. It could not go unnoticed, certainly. And we don't, again, I don't think we can necessarily attribute more to that than is stated. But I tell you what this woman is doing, without a doubt. She is humiliating herself at the feet of Jesus. There is no way to fall at someone's feet, reclined or otherwise, weep all over them, and wipe their feet with your hair, pour ointment on them, and look dignified and sophisticated. You can't do it. This woman has humiliated herself. Now, not just at anybody's feet, but she learned that Jesus was there. She sought Jesus out, not some rabbi, not some teacher, Jesus. She came looking for him. And she fell at his feet and she humbled herself. Now, again, I think there's a lesson in that from her to us. If we come to the Lord and say, well, I'm happy to serve you so long as I can look good doing it, we're not going to be able to be disciples very long. If we're unwilling to be humbled and then humiliated by our love and devotion, because we're going to look foolish to the world. There's just no way around that. If we're really devoted and if we're really committed, we're going to look foolish to the world. And this woman looked foolish. Among other things, she looked foolish. And so Simon says, if this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner. And so Simon is scandalized by this scene that is playing out before him, and he's scandalized that Jesus is letting this pass without comment, without revulsion at his association with this woman who at some point has done something notoriously bad that has left her with this reputation. And so Jesus has a response to this. He says, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he replied, say it, teacher. Now, there is some respect in that response, in that he calls Jesus teacher, which was a sign of respect. So there's some respect there. And Jesus tells this parable. He says, a moneylender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they were unable to repay, he graciously forgave them both. So which of them will love him more? Simon answered and said, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. And he said to him, you have judged correctly. And so Jesus tells us this very simple parable, very simple story about a money lender who has lent money to two different people, and it was not then like it is now. Okay? You didn't have discretionary debt. There weren't sort of credit cards or people, you know, now people go in debt to buy a cheeseburger. But then you didn't go into debt unless you absolutely had to. You had fallen on hard times if you went into debt. And so these two people borrow money, one 50 denarii and one 500 denarii. And we're told that neither one could repay. And so what are we talking about here? Well, we're talking roughly, and this is rough, okay? It's not, don't come to me afterwards with math. But it's roughly 2 months' salary for a day laborer on the 50 denarii side of things, or 2 years' salary for a day laborer on the 500 denarii side of things. So you think about 2 months of your income or 2 years of your income. That's pretty stiff on both sides of the equation, okay? And so, but the point is, neither one can repay. They do not have the wherewithal to repay. And the money lender forgives them both. But remember, neither one can repay. It's not like the one fellow saying, well, 50, I can pull that together if you give me enough time. No, they can't. They can't pull it together. They don't have it. They don't have the wherewithal to pay. And so one of the things we have to see is that the parable highlights not the reality of the debt, but the perception. Because if I can't pay, let's say I owe $1 million to somebody, and this is not, I'm not trying to make a present day equivalent to any of the amounts in the parable, that's not the point. Let's say I owe $1 million to somebody. And I'm never going to come up with that. Would it be any different if it was 10 million or 100 million or 40 billion? Or it doesn't matter. If I'm never going to be able to repay it, the amount is just academic. And that's the case here. It's just the number doesn't matter. What Jesus is getting at is that one of the people in this equation perceives his debt to be small, and one of the people in this equation perceives his debt to be big. Whether or not Simon had really sinned less than the woman, I have no idea. But he thought so. And so Jesus says, which one's going to love more? And Simon thinks about it. And this is where I have some hope for Simon, because he gives the right answer. He calls Jesus teacher and he gives the right answer. And right answers to parables aren't all that common in the Gospels. He says, well, I suppose the one, and some people think, well, he grudgingly admitted that that was the case. Maybe. Whether he's grudging or contemplative, I don't know. But he gave the right answer. He says, the one who forgave more loves more. And Jesus says, yeah, that's right. You understand. You understand. You have judged correctly. And so now, Jesus begins to explain. And this question is almost humorous. Jesus looks at the woman at his feet, and he says, Simon, do you see this one? That's all he can see. That's the only thing he's been looking at. He said, I want to tell you about this woman. And then he begins to rebuke Simon. He says, I entered your house and you gave me no water for my feet. But she's wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but since the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with perfume. Now, I want to pause there just a moment. Just a moment. There's a new economy here that we need to know. Because Jesus is telling us that this woman's behavior is exemplary in this situation. Because what she is displaying, what he's going to go on to talk about, is she is displaying love for God. She's displaying love for God. Now, we know Simon knew all too well the core of the message of God from Moses, the core of the Torah. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. That's it. That's the heart of everything. Who understood that in this whole scene, in this whole scenario as it plays out? Who really got that? Who really had their head wrapped around, you shall love the Lord your God? Who had their heart in that? Who had their soul in that? Who had their might in that? It was the woman. It was the woman. She gets it. Now, if we go back and we think about Deuteronomy 6 and we think about who that statement was made to, it was made to a group of people who were singularly unworthy and who had been rescued anyway. And this woman loves because she understands that she too is singularly unworthy. She does not deserve the forgiveness she's received. She doesn't deserve it. Simon doesn't feel like he's received that much forgiveness. The danger is he may be right in that. You understand what I'm saying? Because he doesn't have the right attitude. He feels like he really might be worthy. And that is a deadly, deadly attitude. And that is the thing that Jesus is trying to get him to see, and we hope is dawning on his conscience. And then Jesus turns to the woman after having said, "For this reason I say to you, her sins, which are many," and Jesus acknowledges that. Did she have a lot of sin? Yeah. She did. "Her sins, which are many, have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who's forgiven little loves little." Then he said to her, "Your sins have been forgiven." Now, the grammar of this statement indicates, it's perfect, it indicates something that is fully accomplished. Now, different students of this passage handle that in different ways. Some people feel like Jesus had encountered this woman on some other occasion, and he had already forgiven her sins, and now she is coming back to show her love and devotion as a result of that previous forgiveness. That's possible. Some people feel like the love and the forgiveness are all entangled, and the tense simply indicates that it is a done deal. She is completely forgiven, but it happened on this occasion. The students of the original text are divided. But one thing we need to see in the text, and this is the tie back to Luke chapter 5, and it's an important one. Those who were reclining at the table, those who were sitting around watching this unfold, understood that Jesus is forgiving sins. Because they say, "Who is this man who even forgives sins?" Now, Luke has already established that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. Jesus has already established that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. And whenever and wherever that happened, Jesus is the one who did it. And Jesus is the one she loves. Her love is expressed to him. He's not just announcing a reality, but he is declaring something for which he has authority. Now, Jesus doesn't engage that at all on this occasion. That's been asked and answered already. Refer to what happened with the paralytic. Asked and answered already. Jesus has already demonstrated his authority to forgive sins. So he says to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Now, maybe that's not what we expected. Because he has already said, "Her sins, which are many, have been forgiven, for she loved much." But he doesn't talk about her love, he talks about her faith. And love and faith are entangled in one another. And that's another point that we need to draw out of this. At some point, she came to Jesus trusting that she would find in him forgiveness and salvation. And that trust led to love, devotion, and appreciation. Love cannot long survive apart from trust. Trust will not long exist without provoking love. And she demonstrates both. She is a prototype for all those who would come to Jesus. That is, we must recognize that we are unworthy, singularly unworthy. And if we are to follow Jesus, we need to do that motivated out of trust in him and love for what he has done for us. That's where she was. This woman, whatever she'd done, wherever she'd been, understood her relationship to God far better and far more clearly than Simon. Now, if you've given them both a Bible test, you know, started firing questions from Leviticus at them, probably Simon would have come out on top of them. But that's not really the point here. The point is, if we're going to follow Jesus, and if we're going to love Jesus like we should, we first need to recognize how unworthy we are of His love and how that love came to us anyway. And Simon shows us just how deadly it is to think either I'm a pretty good guy, or, well, I've got my weak spots, but I'm better than that fellow over there. Because the moment we feel morally superior to the worst sinner, we are crippled in regard to serving and loving God. And one hopes that Simon saw the implications of his answer. But I said earlier that I wanted to talk about this idea, and we'll conclude with this. I wanted to talk about this idea of the woman not being named. This is not... I don't know what happened there. You might want to take out your songbooks. Turn to 832. The woman is not one specific sinner, somehow different